In one of his cantos in Savitri, Sri Aurobindo reminds us, we must discover the secret bond in things, reconstitute the lost divine idea, re-wed the lonely consonants with the open vowels of infinity. 100 years ago, Sri Aurobindo started a journal called the Arya. And in the Arya, there was a question of the month which people would ask him. And the very first question was, what is the characteristic problem of the age and what is the needed synthesis? And Sri Aurobindo points out at the pinpoints at the malady. And he says the characteristic of the age is a divorce between man's own different faculties, between reason and faith, between the faculties of the head and the faculties of the heart. The heart and the head are a single deity. And he says that the needed synthesis is undoubtedly that of man himself. It is often described, today's age in which we live, as an age of rapid information transfer and great connectivity. There is all kinds of instruments of communication which flood our markets and fill our pockets. The paradox is that it is also an age of great disconnectivity. So while we are superficially connected to almost anyone, anywhere in the world, we have got increasingly disconnected with our own deepest self. As if this was not enough, we are disconnected with the world around us. We are disconnected with deeper realities in this cosmos. We are disconnected with whatever, if at all, exists beyond this cosmos. And that is the source of all our troubles, our maladies, the deep malaise, the suffering and pain we have to go through again and again. Time to time, humanity experiences this disconnectedness and tries ways and means to recover it. In fact, much of this effort at trying to improve communication is basically a recognition of this deeper malady. Only the means that we are devising are inadequate, which we will discover as we go by. But the Vedas are one of the first, earliest attempt of humanity to rediscover itself, to locate itself in this cosmos. And for that, when we approach the Vedas, we often approach it as a book of reverence, as a book, you know, which is a sacred scripture, and as a book which is written in difficult Sanskrit, and we approach it with a scholarly mind, and therefore the Vedas don't reveal their secret to us, because we don't approach it as the quest of humanity. And till we do that, we cannot really accept them, make it our own. What really are the Vedas? Who were these rishis? What were they doing, writing such abstruse scriptures? They were very much like all of us. They had the same issues, the same problems. Only they were looking for lasting solutions, because somewhere in that age, man lived more and more by the intuition that is inbuilt in human beings. And that intuition keeps on haunting us day and night, that there is behind this world of phenomenal appearances a deeper reality. Whether we deny it, whether we acknowledge it, we cannot rest in peace till we have really gone far deep into its search. What we find as a result of their search is a different matter. They found it, as the Vedic Rishis say. They found it in different ways, at different levels. And therefore, the Vedas are a very fascinating book in the sense that they are not like, though very much we like to believe, or people, you know, make us believe that just as there is the Bible as a sacred scripture in Christianity or Quran in Islam, so Hindus have the Vedas. But there is a fundamental difference. The difference is, as the Vedas themselves declare, that Vedaha Anantoha, it's an endless scripture. So within it, there is its own corrective. This scripture cannot be subjected to any dogmatic belief, assertion. This is an endless discovery. Vedas are not a finished book. In fact, what we today have received as the Vedas, many of the verses are lost. The second part, the beauty of this scripture is, it is not sacred because God spoke it, but it is sacred because the soul heard it. That's why they are called as Shrutis. It's not God spoke it. Well, God speaks in so many ways, but the soul heard it. And because the soul heard it, they can be renewed in our experience. It's not just a question of believing or not believing. They can be renewed because the original Veda is not a book, but it is something which is, as Shubindo says, written in the heart of every living creature. That is the original Veda. It's written in matter itself. If you go to Veda, literally the meaning, its root meaning comes from vid, to know, it's knowledge. It's not a knowledge, not an informational knowledge, not a book knowledge. But it's a knowledge that is ingrained in the very stuff of things, in the very nature of things. And that knowledge unfolds itself in so many ways. A thing as simple as two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen coming together forming water. Why does that happen? Because at its root, there is a knowledge which fashions things into a certain way. The seed of a certain plant grows into a certain tree. It's because there is behind it a consciousness. The weaving of the stars as a necklace in the heavens is because there is Veda at the root of this creation. Man's quest for immortality, his search for God, for meaning, for purpose, for perfection, is because there is Veda written in our hearts. That is the beauty of the Vedas. But what really are they? I mean, if you really look at an external way of looking at it, then we have these three main Vedas and the fourth one, and I don't really wish to go into it because it's more of a scholarly way of looking at it and disconnects us actually from the Vedas. But the quest of the Vedic Rishis was essentially a quest for immortality. They looked at the world of impermanence, of changing appearances, and they wondered, is there behind this creation something which is durable, something which endures, something which lasts or outlasts the rub and change, the flux and flow of time, something which is eternal, something which is imperishable. And this quest began for them. The beginning of this quest had to be within the individual. And this quest began with the lighting of something called the fire. Now the beauty of this Vedic period is that they wrote their sublime experience in a twofold way. Outwardly, the experiences could relate to the physical objects and physical symbols of everyday life. But inwardly, they connected it to deeper psychological experiences. So they remain always accessible to us. What really is this fire that the Vedic Rishis worshipped? It was evidently the fire of aspiration in man. And if we light up the same fire, we will go through the same experiences of the Vedic Rishis. For instance, they speak of the threefold fire and the fivefold fire. The first fire which lights up in the body. We can take just one small little story to see how, you know, beautifully through many of these symbols, the Vedic Rishis brought out deep psychological truths. There is, you know, one of these stories of Ushasti Chakrayan. He is a very interesting Rishi, who though he is a knower of the Vedas, but yet he is helpless before outer circumstances. We often believe that a man who has Vedic knowledge or who has risen to wisdom can just veil power. This search for power came much later. But so Shasti Chakrayan, there is a famine in the in his all around, and he is in search of someone who can give him some food to eat. He is famished to death, and he goes into a household and says, "Do you have something to eat?" And he says, "Something I have eaten and something is left from my savings and you can have it." So he has that. So then the person offers him water. So Shasti Chakrayan says, "No, I don't need water." He says, "But why? You asked for food and I have given you. Why can't you take water?" He says, "No, food was my necessity. I would have died without that. But water I can still hold on." So that is the kind of character. And Ushasti Chakrayan then goes back at his home. Next day there is a yagna, to cut a long story short, and he goes to the king's palace. And there are different people who are performing a yagna. And he asks them a question that, "Tell me, you who are going to start the yagna, who is the deity whom you worship when you start the yagna?" So he says, "I don't really know. I know the mantras, but I don't know who is the real deity." So he says, "Well, if you don't know the deity, it doesn't make sense. You simply, you know, recite mantras meaninglessly." Then he asks the second one, because there are three stages in which the rituals are performed. So first is that you start the process like an initiation. Then the process goes on, and at the end there is, as we know, prasadam. The whole yagna is complete and prasad will be distributed. So he says, "Who is the second deity, the Udgita, who is invoking?" He says, "I don't know really the sense of the deity. I just know that I have these mantras for so and so deity, but I don't really understand." So he asks the third one, "When you complete the sacrifice, who is the deity?" So all three are not able to answer, and Ushasti Chakrayan is given the task of performing the yagna. So at the end of it, he's asked the same question, that tell us, who is the deity? He says, "When the initiating deity is Agni. So first thing is to invoke that Agni. Without that flame of aspiration, we really cannot understand the Vedas, because it is this which maketh a man. Truly, if there is something which marks humanity different from the animal creation, is this flame of aspiration which makes man at once the most dissatisfied creature upon earth. Because he is always seeking." Shobindu describes it beautifully in Savitri. "A long, dim preparation is man's life. An endless circle of toil and war and hope, dragged by life upon matter's obscure ground." Then he says, "Search for an ideal never made real here. This is what always with as human beings, we really become human beings when we begin to seek. And this seeking is the fire, which is the first deity. It's the initiation." Now we have so much hullabaloo about initiation. How did the Vedic rishis initiate? It was not by anything external. It was by this fire of aspiration. And they had their way of testing humanity. There is a very interesting little story of how they really knew whether a person was ready or not. So one of the stories it's probably a well-known story of Satyakam Chabali, where the little boy tells his mother, "I want to learn Brahma Vidya." And he is the boy of a maid servant. So she says, "All right, go to the nearby Rishi. Rishi Gautama will teach you." So he goes, and Rishi Gautama says, "Look, I don't admit anyone and everyone. So you must tell me, fill up this form, tell me who is your father, who is your mother, come back to me tomorrow." So he goes and asks his mother, "Mother, I know you, but I don't know my father. I've never seen him. So I have to fill up this form and enroll myself." And the lady tells him, "Jabali, well, as for mother, you can be sure that I am your mother. I don't know who your dad is, because I have worked with many persons when you were conceived. Look at the strength of the story, the wideness of the vision. And this boy goes and says, I know who my mother is, but I don't know who my dad is. And immediately the guru says, well, you are fit to be enrolled for Brahmagyana. Because only somebody who has such courage, such honesty, the Vedic knowledge is not for hypocrisy or not for hypocrites. It's for those who are ready to lead an honest life, a genuine life, not a life of show that one is very religious, one is very... It's a quest, inner quest. And he is admitted and he grows up and there is a very, you know, how the guru teaches him, that is also very interesting. How the knowledge was imparted. So the guru tells him, okay, you take 100 cows, lean and thin. When they grow into 400 good milking cows, you come back. Now, the child is keen on having Brahmagyana and he accepts the guru's adesh and he goes into the forest. Now look at this beauty of the story, that very often our mind is right now conditioned that knowledge comes from books or from Google Baba or from, you know, some such thing. It's to be acquired from outside. But true knowledge doesn't come from outside. It comes from inside. Now this man has a quest. His quest will lead him. With this fire he goes. And as he tends the cows, knowledge pours to him from every side. It is described in very, very beautiful ways. The fire speaks to him. The wind speaks to him. And at the end of the day, at the end of many years, when he comes back, he has the knowledge. Guru has not spoken anything. He has given him a strange work. And that is why when people come, you know, Sri Aurobindo Ashram Pondicherry, when I think Vedalankarji had come there, who was a Pandit of Vedas, lived up to 108 years. And when he saw the ashram, he says, oh, here I find that truly the Vedic life of which I have dreamed all my life, that is being lived there. Now strangely, in Pondicherry ashram, people are given different kinds of work. It's not that, okay, from today onwards, you will sit and meditate for so many hours. Satyakam is not given that task. Okay, I am teaching you a method of meditation. Please meditate this way, every day 2.5 hours. He is not taught that. He says, go and tend the cows. Now look how Veda operates. In every action, there is the operation of that knowledge. And to one who is awake, it will pour in. And that is how he grows into knowledge. So the very first thing that the Vedic Rishis, the first god whom they really invoked was Agni. And there's so many hymns, Rig Vedas, the first original Vedas are full of hymns to Agni. It starts with a hymn to Agni and it's full of many of these mandalas. Each mandala is attributed to a certain Rishi, which will have suktas and rigs. And the full thing will be a Samhita. That's how the Vedic lore proceeds. And he will describe various ways. You know, at one place the Vedic Rishi will invoke Agni to burn away the impurities, to show him the right path, to light up. It's all an inner quest. It was an age when there were no temples. We can't imagine an age when the only temple that they wanted to create was a temple inside. The place where, you know, God seems to have hid himself from, as Sri Aurobindo says, from man's profaning touch. Because every outer temple has been corrupted from Kanyakumari to Badrinath. Even Badrinath you will find just by the side of the main place, you will find India's last tea shop. And you will find coke tins and everything else. And people walking without any quest. Real thing is the quest. He who goes with this quest is on the path of the Vedas. But what was the first necessity? What was the next? They moved through. They discovered that behind man's individual existence, there are a host of cosmic powers. So the second step after lighting the individual fire was to enlarge our being. We are right now dealing with very, very small things, very small life. As people say, we are bogged down with the necessities of material existence, which are truly never ending, because every 8 hours we feel hungry again. So it will be never ending. That's why there is a very nice phrase, hunger, that is death. That's how the Upanishad describes it. Because we are hungry, we feed, and we again feel hungry. And therefore material existence ties us. But there is another cycle of movement of nature in which we can enter. A movement which is akin to the gods. And in the Vedas we find this next step. This Agni wants to bring down Indra, the luminous one. This is the second godhead whom they worship. And who is Indra? It is the first necessity to convert our normal outward going information processing, or rather appearance processing, rational mentality into an illumined mind. That's what Indra represents. He's the illumined mind. And there's a very interesting story about what is this illumined mind? How does it operate? This is a story of Indra and Virochana, when the two of them, so I'm fulfilling my promise of stories. So the story goes that Indra and Virochana, they both go and ask Brahma, tell us about the self. What is the true self? So Brahma says, see, the true self is in your eyes. So look into your eyes and you'll find the self. So now how do you look into our eyes? We can look into other parts, but how do we look into our eyes? Actually, it is to look within. Eyes are the only organs through which we look. We can look at everything else. But how do we look at our eyes? So they look into a lake, they devise an ingenious way. They look into the lake and they see, now we see our eyes. So they say, well, we know what is the self. But what kind of self is this? So they say, okay, dress yourself in beautiful adornments and now look. So they see and they say, this is beautiful. This must be the self. It's a story, very interesting story. So both of them go away. Virochana is satisfied. He is an Asura Raj. He goes and tells them the real self is the body. And therefore, look after this body, take care of this body, make sure that the body is happy and the bodily needs are satisfied, and you will find the self, because they know the self. But Indra says this body is subject to all kinds of death. It's subject to change, mutation. How can this be the true self? So while Indra and Virochana are away, Brahma is telling Narada, you know, they have left in a hurry. They are very impatient fellows. They should have waited. I have just taught them the very first step. So Indra comes back. Says, how can this be the true self? It is changing all the time. Okay, when I wear a nice adornment, it looks nice. But also if I am lame, I look lame. If I am blind, I look blind. How can this be the true self? So Brahma says, now you come. So first 32 years he has spent about this first part, in the second part, higher secondary, in spiritual education. So he says, okay, now try to observe that self which is in dream, which is very different from your waking self. It always remains young, it can do things which your physical self cannot do. And after much learning, Indra masters the science of the dream self. And he goes back. Again he comes. His quest is not satisfied. He comes and says, no, but this too, I have discovered, is subject to mutation, is bound by certain laws. But what is that self which is free and eternal? So he says, well, it is the sleeping self, the self which you discover when everything else sleeps, when everything else is asleep, still there is a self which comes back and there is a continuity of experience which is not lost. So he goes back and then he says finally that, look, there is a fourth self in which all these three are unified, the waking, dream and the sleep self, and that is the real self. So it takes 101 years and eventually Indra discovers the true self. So it's an illumined mind. What is the beauty of the illumined mind? Illumined mind by its nature is a seeker of knowledge. It grows into knowledge. It's open to knowledge. It's open to deeper truths. It does not mistake the apparent for the real or the surface for the deeper things. This difference can be, you know, easily understood in this way, that there are people who try to understand the deeper truths on the basis of the surface. It is a typical outer pragmatic mind. For instance, they will say, oh, God is everywhere. So, how is he everywhere at the same time? He is inside me. Is he in my physical heart? This is a way of understanding the deeper by the surface. But illumined mind will understand it very differently. An example of this is when, in another story, Bhrigu is asked, tell us, how is this all-pervading reality? Formless in a sense, yet everywhere. So he gives the example of salt dissolving in water. He says, look, taste it from different points. He puts the water in different measures. What is the taste? It's salty. It's salty, salty. Can you find salt in it? No. Can you see salt in it? No. But it is there because it dissolved. It has become the very essence of things. We have that famous song, Bulla Ke Jana Main Kaun. It's, you know, who am I? So he discovers that, well, I am the very essence of all things. So this is how the illumined mind. So the first task of this Agni is to convert our outward going intellect, which is involved with surface things. All the time our mind is busy. In practical terms, what it would mean if we were to practice a Vedic yoga. That once this Agni is kindled, it is not enough that, you know, we sit for meditation for half an hour. This must become a living fire for us. Then the fire itself will speak and reveal. Our very mind should not be satisfied with surface appearances. Surface appearances may be very pleasant. They may be very frightening. They keep changing. But go deeper into it. What is there at the depth? What is there at the depth? What is behind this tree? Is there an abiding reality? It is Brahman. What is Brahman? What is behind this pillar? As Prahlad says, there is divine behind. And Hiranyakashipu says, no, it is just a lump of matter. What is behind this human being? What is behind that beast, bird, stone? How beautifully Shubhendu puts it, in the blue of the sky, in the green of the forest. Whose is the hand that has painted the glow when the winds were asleep in the womb of the ether? Who was it roused them and bade them to blow? In the strength of a man, in the beauty of woman, how behind everything one can feel that presence. So first task is this mind should be changed into an illumined mentality, which is the task of Indra. And he makes sure, he will give all kinds of tests to ensure that are we really, really seeking that. And if we keep on seeking, then slowly the mind begins to change into a new mode of operation. The way we normally arrive at informational knowledge is not the way that we can arrive at the Vedic truths. That's why it is said that for the knowledge of God, we have to have another kind of operation of the mind. It's not possible through the analytical mind. Many things we cannot know through the analytical mind. A simple thing like everyday experience. You know, there is a very nice movie that had come. And in that, this is shown very nicely. I forget the name of the movie. I've just seen bits of it, but that part was very illustrative. It was like Veda coming through this movie. So husband and wife get married and then they have a baby. So the husband says, okay, I'll look after, you know, you don't worry, you sleep, I'll take care of the baby. So at night the baby cries. So husband has read the book. He has read everything about the baby. And so he gets up. And he, you know, gets some milk and tries to feed. But the baby doesn't suckle at all. He's just not as if bothered. He doesn't know what to do. And then suddenly the mother gets up. He says, no, you don't get it. Basically, the baby is feeling very warm. So she removes the blanket and the baby is quiet and sleeps. So the next day again, the baby gets up at night. So he remembers, oh, the baby must be feeling warm. So he removes the blanket. The great baby cries even more. He said, no, baby needs to feel more cozy. And she puts an additional blanket. The third day the baby cries. And you know, one day it is something else, one day it's something else. But the language is the same. The baby is crying. How does the mother know? It's not through a book, it's not through analysis, but by a kind of identification with the consciousness of the child. Which is something which is inbuilt within us as a faculty and a capacity, which we hardly use it. We hardly develop it. What is called as, it's the first way of intuition. In fact, we every day experience it. How do we know we are hungry? We don't analyze the chemicals. We don't test our blood sugar and say, oh, blood sugar is low, I am hungry. We know we are hungry. How do we know we are angry? Even when nobody knows, we know we are angry. Because we identify with that. How do we know that we exist? Because we identify with something. Now, this capacity can be extended and developed to any degree. And that is how the Vedic rishis went about converting their mental operations into a new form of mentality. That's why Indra is also called the master of all the Indriyas. He has the all these Indriyas, the senses are projections of our mind to grasp reality. But if you go to the master, Indra is the master of all these, he can directly know the same thing without the use of Indriyas. So that's why Indra is also regarded as the inner mind. But this was not enough. They were not satisfied with this. So the quest went further. Look at the adventure of these rishis. They were not satisfied just with gathering new ways of knowledge and playing with that. So they were in search of an absolute truth, something which is there behind the universe. And before they can go there, they have to become fit. So there were other gods, for instance, Ashwins, Ribhus. Ribhus in the Vedas are called artisans of immortality. And how do they make, help fashion immortality within us? Through the Ashwins, who actually clear the nervous system of all obstructions. Because if we approach that truth, the closer we go, we run the risk of even losing our head. It's a real adventure. There are stories in the Upanishad. One such story is the Samvad between Gargi and Yajnavalk. There is a whole meeting and Gargi asks him on what is this based and what is that based. And finally she goes to, she starts with, what is that light with which we all see? So Yajnavalk says the sun. Okay, when the sun is not there, the moon. When the moon is not there, the fire. When the fire is not there, the self. It says, on what is this self woven? So Yajnavalk cautions her, Gargi, one more question and your head will fall off. It's the limits to which our human mind can take. Beyond it, we have to be ready. So these things prepare us, these gods prepare us. And then there are the four great guardians of the truth. This is very beautifully described in the Vedas, that these guardians of truth will come and they will see whether we are ready or not. And these, they go in pair. It's very interesting. The first pair is Varuna and Mitra. And the second is Bhag and Ahriman. So Varuna and Mitra psychologically have very interesting functions. And see how it attacks at every dogmatism. Varuna is the lord of vastness. And his operations are described in a very short, terse story. And the story is of all of us. Sunushep is tied at the stake, where he is tied with three cords and he is being offered a sacrifice, just like us. We don't even realize that we are being sacrificed by nature for something and we are tied at the stake of life. We don't even realize it. And he cries, help me, help me. Oh God, help me. And Varuna comes to his rescue. And as the story goes, he cuts the upper string and throws it above. He cuts the second string, throws it on the sides. He cuts the lower strings and throws it below. What are these three cords? Upper cord is our mind, which will not allow us to go beyond physical mind. And this mind, the strings are cut and this mind is allowed to enter into the higher domains. The second is the life force, which is moving in a very, very small area. And it cuts and universalizes, makes the life force in us merge into a universal life which is all around. And the third is the physicality, the animality, the string which holds us back, and he cuts it and throws it down. So Varuna is the god of vastness. He makes us vast. Look at the precondition for truth. Narrow-mindedness cannot lead us to truth. The first simple lesson. Bigotry cannot lead us to truth. Dogmatism cannot lead us to truth. By its nature, the quest of truth is only possible if the mind becomes vast, to which the mother will add vast and supple. Because truth is not a fixed measure. It is something which is constantly revealing itself in myriad ways. So the mind has to become supple. So Varuna first comes and makes us our mind vast. There are so many prayers the Vedic Rishis pray. Make us vast. The vast, the right, the true. That is how they have defined that reality. Satyam, Ritam, Vratam. So where does the Rit come in? The problem of vastness is that even few ideas the mind finds difficulty in accommodating in the small box. Imagine when the mind is jostled with million ways of looking at life, what would happen to it? Now there is a way that each of these truths is arranged according to the deeper law of things. And Rit is that power by which we intuitively know how each thing must find its true place in this cosmos. Now this Rit, the Lord who fashions this Rit is Mitra. That's why Mitra actually is also love. His, but the right translation is harmony. That's why even today when we talk about friends, the word used is Mitra. Who is Mitra? Somebody with whom we have harmony. If there is no harmony, whatever may be outwardly called, it's not a Mitra. Mitra by nature is harmony. That's why the best relation that it can exist between human beings, including husband and wife, including man and woman, is the relation of friendship. Because as Mitra, life would be wonderful. As husband, wife, as father, son, as, you know, child and mother, it tends to break down. But as friends, Mitra. So Mitra is the Lord of harmony, and he harmonizes not only relationships between human beings, but relationships between man and the cosmos, between different powers of the cosmos. So Varuna and Mitra are the first ones. They are a pair. They both move together. In the ashram, the typical example was Nalinda and Amrita. Nalinda was known to have embodied the consciousness of Varuna within himself. And Amrita was, the two were almost... The rooms were side to side. Those who have gone to ashram know it. And they would come out and go to the dining room together. Nalinda would be always as if serious. If somebody would look at him and greet, he would as if, not even look, or he would say, that's it. With Amrita, he would be looking all around. Bonjour, good morning, bye-bye. So friendly. And they were together. It's literally like the Vedic gods Varuna and Mitra, that they go together. And these two were the first things that the Vedic Rishis wanted to acquire. And they labored at it. It was not easy. It's not easy for a consciousness which is bound to habits. That's why when Mother was asked how to prepare ourselves for the supramental truth, she says, one important thing is thirst. If you have the thirst, wherever you are, whatever your outer life is, you are marked out. And the second, she says, do not cling. Do not cling to any habit. Do not cling to any idea. Do not cling to any opinion. And she says, the worst kind of ideas are ideas which belong to our moral notions, ascetic ideas. This is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. Of course, this is a very vast doctrine. It's not meant for... The Vedic Rishis knew this vastness can be disorienting. So therefore, as we see, they clothed it in double meaning. Those who were initiate could understand that when the Rishis speak of this vastness, they know that for action, we need to move from a lesser to a greater good. We have to make a distinction between what is evil, because it has to go out of creation, which was good at one point of time, and what is the good that is coming, which will yet be replaced by yet greater good. So it was a very subtle truth. So therefore they clothed it in a double sense, because for a non-initiate, it can be very disorienting. That's why in India, sannyasis were a breed apart. They were supposed to be away. You welcome sannyasi for a day in his house, but if he lives for an year or 2 years, it can be very dangerous because he may upset all the notions. Life is very comfortable, but he is living in a vast inner freedom. Shobhinda has used this word. His world is a world of vast inner freedom. He is not bound by our notions, our ideas, our smallnesses, our bigotries, and it's very difficult to live with that freedom. So that's why the Vedic Rishis also spoke of two paths that we have to take successively. And what were these two paths? Those who are watching the Mahabharata must have read about it or earlier. Uttarayan and Dakshinayan. You know, Bhishma says, I will not shed my body in Dakshinayan and Uttarayan. What is this Dakshinayan and Uttarayan? They are also called in the same thing in another context as Pitriyan and Devyan. So Pitriyan is the vehicle. So these are the two paths. The Pitriyan or the Dakshinayan is the path of the fathers. And Devyan or the Uttarayan is the path of the gods. So first we take the path of the fathers. What is this path of the fathers? This is the path of life, of our ordinary physical, vital, mental existence. And we have to lead it the way our fathers led it, by dharma. Not fathers literally, but the way of dharma. And when we lead it this way, then we get prepared for the next level, where we are in that vastness as freedom. We can't jump from our animal state to that. We'll be confused. So the next step is Devyayan or Uttarayan. So the inferior path is the Dakshinayan. So that's why, you know, Duryodhan tells Bhishma, if you die now, you will suffer for your sins. Actually, that's not true. What is said is that those who follow the path of Dakshinayan, they come back again into human life. And those who follow the Uttarayan, they don't come back. They go to the solar light. Now, what it means is that even dharma, life of dharma, binds us. We come back. And yet, that life is the first step as a preparation for the next life. And that life is the Uttarayan. So, you know, they knew that human life moves. These are the two stages. Of course, there is a stage below of which many of us are part, so we don't talk about it, that the Vedic Rishis were least really concerned about. And that was the defect of that age, incidentally. But they were concerned about man's progress. When the urge for progress becomes conscious, then the Vedic Yoga begins. Similarly, there are two other, now out of these four guardians of the truth, one is Varuna and Mitra, and on the other hand, there is Bhag and Ahriman. They also go together, and it's very interesting. Ahriman is the warrior and Bhag is the enjoyer. What a paradox. Just like Varuna and Mitra. Varuna goes into vastness, vast sky beyond. But Mitra will harmonize everything. Similarly, Bhaga is the god of enjoyment. He really shows us what is the right way to enjoy this universe, enjoy life, enjoy creation, happiness, which is the Vedic Rishis regarded happiness as a valid goal of existence. It was not something which they invalidated, only they said to be truly happy, you have to be vast, you have to have the nature of a warrior which sheds the inferior enjoyment for a greater delight. So that is how they proceeded. So very often people say, oh, I have to shed this material life. No, it's not like that. We make a choice. We make a choice between an inferior mode of happiness or a greater mode of happiness. And based on our choice, we move up. So Ahriman prepares the way for Bhag. When like a warrior, we have shed, cut off the bonds of darkness and ignorance. When we have rejected the inferior mode of life to which we are bound, then we are ready for the next level of enjoyment. This aspect of Ahriman in Bhaga is brought out in a very small verse, the very first verse of the Ishupanishad, whose power is so much that this verse alone can rescue Indian civilization out of its greatest darkness. And what is that verse? Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kinch Jagat Yam Jagat. And from that it derives the next one. Tena Tyaktena Bhunjita Magrida Kasyasvitinam. It's the same truth. By renouncing, thou shalt enjoy. So renunciation is not a painful process. This is another thing in the mind. Oh my God, I have to sacrifice this, I have to sacrifice that. It is natural. In fact, if we are feeling pain, it's not a sacrifice, not regarded as sacrifice. We are not to mortify ourselves. But it's something which naturally begins to drop off as the love of the divine grows. When we discover, when we have tasted a drop of it, and we discover that there is nothing in this universe comparable to that, Every time after the taste, one goes back to the inferior mode, one feels, oh, what a letdown. What that beauty, that wonder, that glory, that closeness. And here I am again tasting mud and mire. So this is the Ahriman. Ahriman battles. He's a warrior like Kali. He prepares our nature for what? For bhaga, for divine enjoyment. When all these four gods have worked and tested us and thoroughly perfected the human vessel, or as the Vedic Rishi said, baked the clay, then we are ready for entry into the highest godhead, whom they called as Surya Savitri. It was the light of truth that exists in the beyond, the transcendent. So first we see the individual, the fire, then we see the universal, vastness, harmony not only within us but with the whole creation and cosmos, because we know the right law of everything. Divine enjoyment, a battling between the forces, participating in that great battle where we fight against ignorance and obscurity wherever it is found. That's how Shivindo defined Arya in his very first. Somebody asked him why you have called your journal Arya, who is the Arya? And he says Arya is not a geographical type. So beautifully, Arya is a psychological type of humanity that battles against darkness and obscurity and ignorance within and without. And whatever it conquers, it does not trample below his feet, but ennobles it. That's the other aspect of the Aryan victory. Unlike the Asura, when he conquers something, he destroys it, decimates it. It crushes under the head, but Aryan will not do it. The true Arya, when it conquers something, it will ennoble it, make it flower, make it bloom, make it something very beautiful. Its conquests are not for simply, you know, self-expansion, but in the highest sense of the self, for the expansion of the divinity within this creation. And from that was derived in the ancient Vedic culture, very interesting yagna, Ashwamedh yagna. Very interesting yagna actually. And in that yagna, people go on conquest. And somebody who performs Ashwamedh yagna is declared as a samrat. Now what is this Ashwamedh yagna? What kind of yagna is this where there is no fire and people are going with arrow killing each other? This was the inner sense. Because you see what way this Vedic culture tried to bring itself. Just as there are the four main Vedas, first three and then the fourth one, Athar Veda, there also came certain branches which came, you know, which were like applied Vedas, which are called as Upvedas. And among the Upvedas, we have Ayurveda. We also have Shastra, Shastra Veda, Shastra Astra Veda. We have Dhanur Veda, Pushpa Ayurveda. From that knowledge, there grew a whole branch. So, you know, when in Dhanurvidya, who were the great, you know, even Brahmastra, powers of the cosmos could be materialized in creation, and who could do it? Only somebody who was a great tapasvi. This was the precondition. And we see those stories where, you know, if you were not ready, for instance, Arjuna, why was Arjuna given these great weapons? Arjuna was known to be Jitendriya. He had mastered his senses. He had mastered its sleep. He had mastered its hunger. So he had done all this tapasya, and therefore he could attain these great. So did Karna also master many of these things. Then only one was a qualifier to these great weapons which one got through Brahma Vidya. Strangely, that these were weapons one got through Brahma Vidya. And then how does one know? So a person who felt that he is the right person to govern not just a small kingdom but large expanse of bhumi in the way of dharma, he performed this Ashwamedh yagya. Ashwa is the force. So he spreads his force through yagna for the fulfillment of dharma, not for just his kingdom's expansion but for the fulfillment of dharma. That is how, you know, Yudhishthira performed the Ashwamedh. Not every king could perform Ashwamedh yagna. He had to be truly a samrat in the real sense of the word, that is, master of his own self, master of nature around. So how this culture really grew around these great truths, and it did not stop at anything short of that ultimate reality. So now the question comes, if such was the greatness of the culture, what happened to it? Why did it vanish? Well, it doesn't vanish to start with, because as I said, Vedas are not a book. Vedas are written in the heart of creation. It was the first dawn which gave us a promise, as Shobindu says in Savitri, the very first canto. Almost that day the epiphany was disclosed. It came to show us what is possible. The Vedic rishis were not evolutionary beings. They were involutionary beings who came from higher planes, who gave these truths to humanity and showed them that, look, this is your future. Go ahead. But it was obviously the mass of humanity was still struggling. It was not ready. So one of the defects of the Vedic age, if you may use the word defect, but a limitation rather, a natural limitation, because you can't take a leap straight away, was that it was not, this movement of the Vedic wisdom was not meant for the masses. So the language of the Vedas was prone to an external interpretation. Though always it contained key, and if you got that key, you got it right. Otherwise it always appeared confusing mass of jumble, mixture of nature worship with suddenly high sublime wisdom. That is how people like Max Müller and others, even Sinai, interpreted them, because they couldn't make sense. Why? Because they were not on the path. It's very simple. If we are on the path, then we understand how beautifully, Ahriman is working in us, how Indra is working in us, and how the Vedic gods appear, how the Rith expresses itself. All this becomes so clear. But if we are not on the path, if we try a scholarly interpretation of the Vedas, then we are lost in a mass of unintelligible things. What are the Vedic rishis asking? They are praying for cows and horses. So, even donkeys, they are, you know, all these are symbols in the Vedas. Cow, the word go means cow as well as light. That's how we have Gomati, Gopal, Golok, you know, everything to do with light. Gupta, concealment of light. But the other interpretation is they were asking for cows so that they can get milk. So they were farmers. Well, they were farmers, Sri Aurobindo says, but farmers who tilled their inner land to bring out the seeds of the divine plenty. So in that sense, they were farmers. Ashwa, force. That's why in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we have a whole image of the cosmic horse. And that image can sometimes, some of these images may appear very crude. Like, you know, in, I think it is the Chandogya, it is in the Rig Vedas, Vamdev, in one of the mandalas, he describes how the immortal has seated himself within man in the form of a bull with two heads and four horns and three legs. That's a very crude image. But if you have the key, you understand that the three legs are the threefold existence of man, physical, vital, mental. Without the fourth, it's incomplete. It cannot stand for long. And the four horns are the four aspects, the four powers we just spoke about. And the two heads are the Purusha and Prakriti, the soul and nature. And the whole image is, it fits to every hymn. Once you have this key, then, you know, the whole thing will fit systematically. That mandala of Vamdev contains a number of rigs and suktas, and it will fit everywhere. But if that key is not there, if one is lost in the very beginning, oh, what kind of an image? It's not even nature, it's something like a perverted, something weird imagination. And one cannot make sense. So that is why when Vedas are approached with a scholarly mind, they don't give their meaning. And because the mass of humanity was not ready, therefore the Vedic civilization had to come down. Because nature always eventually, whatever it be, loves all her children. As the mother says in Savitri, there are those lines. Not only the white gods, but even the black gods are safe, who have revolted and gone away. A mother's love waits with outstretched arms for her rebel sons. And then says, what the white gods missed, they got it because they went away. So eventually everybody, and that's the reason why Shobindu says why the high Trojan civilization had to be brought down, why the great Hastinapur had to collapse, because that capacity was only for the few. No, nature doesn't allow it. So we see towards the end of the Vedic age, an age comes when there is a more and more ritualistic interpretation of the Vedas. It becomes an outward mechanical worship. The ceremonial fire replaces the inner fire. The Indra becomes a god who will fulfill our outer wishes rather than illumining our mentality. And if he is not happy, he will send his vajra and there will be rain and floods and torrents. Varuna will flood us, the inner rivers, the sevenfold rivers which emerge from Sindhu, the parent river, and float towards the twofold ocean of being. Look how beautiful this image is in the Vedas. That human existence moves between two oceans. Below there is an ocean of inconscience, ak prakritim salilam. And above there is the ocean of the superconscient light. And we move in between these two oceans. Shubhendu puts it so simply in this simple image of a tree. A tree beside the sandy river beach. Oh, holding its topmost branches to the skies, like fingers to the heaven they cannot reach. This is the soul of man, his body and brain. Hungry for earth, his heavenly flight to attain. So, you know, we are caught between these two oceans. On one side, the ocean of inconscience, which is constantly trying to swallow us, and the superconscious, which is constantly drawing us. So, the sevenfold rivers, the rivers of inspiration, these powers which awaken as we progress along the path, Saraswati, who gives us the right inspiration, Mahi, the goddess of intuition, Bharati, illumination, Dakshina, the faculty of right discrimination about an action. So all these things became external. And slowly, this external ritualistic interpretation led to the decline of the Vedic age. But it was a necessary eclipsing, because nature wants the whole humanity to come up. Then we come to the next stage. I'll try to quickly, you know, because the Vedic age itself is so fascinating. So now what we find in the Upanishad is suddenly the rishis break free from all this outer mold. This is a very powerful intellectual expression of the truth. And that is so powerful, so direct, that you can't miss it. In the Vedas, it can be missed. But in the Upanishads, that's why the Western scholars, they don't understand the Vedas, but they understand the Upanishads. They say, yes, Upanishadic verses are very powerful, deep, philosophical musing. They are not philosophical musing. Some people even say that the Upanishads were a revolt against the Vedas. But again and again, they quote the Vedas as authorities. Some of the Upanishadic writings are directly from the Vedas. In fact, the mantra is more or less like one of the mantra, Agnene Supatharaye, from the Ish Upanishad, the last mantra, is as if directly lifted bodily from the Rig Veda. So it was not a revolt against the Vedic lore. It was a revelation of the inner truth in mental terms, make it intellectually available, not in an analytical way. But again, the way was the intuitive mind for the masses of mankind. But which masses? Those who were intellectually now developed. They may not be psycho-spiritually open like the Vedic rishis. But they were at least intellectually ready to receive these high truths. And they were given in that form. Like, you know, it describes the divine in this way. Tane jati, tanne jati, tad dure taduvantike, tadantarasya sarvasya yadu asya bahiyat. Or when it describes what is this atma, you know, the Upanishad, Kathopanishad, how beautifully it's very simple, direct, powerful. When Nachiketa asks Yama, tell me the threefold secret. So first is the secret of earthly life and that fire. And the second, the secret of cosmic existence. So first he talks about his first boon relates to his individual life. My father is angry with me, he should be appeased. Very, very simple. The second he asks, well, tell me the secret of immortality. And then Yama reveals to him the entire cosmic creation. And then he asks, some say that after that death, man exists, and some say he does not. So tell me the truth of this. So Yama says, well, even the gods don't know it. Don't ask such a question, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. So Nachiketa says, no, I want this. And then he reveals this truth of what is that, how the soul exists, how it goes beyond, how it journeys, and how to find it. It is seated in the heart. That thou seekest, and repeatedly it says, Nachiketa, first thing you have to learn is Sriyascha Priyascha, learn to distinguish between what is dear to you, pleasant to you, and what is truly worth acquiring. And since you have that, you are the Adhikari. And what powerful verses, न तत्र सूर्यो भाति न चंद्र तारकम नेमा विद्युतो भांति कुतो यमग्नि. आई मीन ऑल दी वर्सेस ऑफ द उपनिषद आर वेरी पावरफुल, वेरी डायरेक्ट, सो दे आर इजी टू ग्रैस्प बाई एटलीस्ट एन ओपन इंटेलेक्चुअल मेंटेलिटी. वॉट इज द स्टेट वेन वी कैन पास बियॉन्ड ग्रीफ? ही सेज हाउ ब्यूटिफुली द ईश उपनिषद पुट्स इट, वी ऑल वॉन्ट टू बी फ्री फ्रॉम ग्रीफ एंड सॉरो, राइट? So we go to psychiatrists, we go here and there, but what a solution in one half a sloka. Who doesn't have grief? Tatra ko moha ka shoka ekatvam anupashyata. He who sees oneness everywhere, whence has she have grief? Whence shall he be deluded? He who sees oneness everywhere, we see division everywhere. This is mine, this is not mine. This division. But where everything belongs to the one, and we dwell with that state of oneness, we live with that state of oneness, where we are simply trustees, not possessors, to put it in very practical terms, where there is grief, nothing really belongs to us. So how can we lose anything? And doesn't everything belong to us? Magradha kasya svidhinam, why, what is the need of acquiring anything? Now this is a state of consciousness in which the yogin can awaken, and in the Upanishads very direct, though there are some 200 plus Upanishads, but 12 are the main principal Upanishads. And again their subject matter is Brahman, the eternal reality. But it is very practical, you know, they teach a whole path and to go into it would be a whole. But again we see that though the intellectual mind has grasped it and certain paths are there, still man is not just the mind. He also has this life impulse, his life which craves for 101 things. So this craving of life says, me too, I too want that knowledge, but I can't understand all this state of grief beyond into this vastness. I'm getting lost. So again the Upanishadic age comes to a decline. And then starts a new movement in Indian thought. It is the age of the Tantra and the Puranas. Tantras also derive themselves from the Vedas. That's why they are called as Agam Shastras. I mean, they are endless in their origin. And but what is the uniqueness of Tantra and Purana? They connect with the life force in man. That's the time of the great Itihasas, Mahabharata and Ramayana. Mahabharata and Ramayana are nothing but Vedas. And once one understands the Vedic lore, one understands everything. Look at Yagyaseni Draupadi. Born out of the fire of sacrifice. What is the sacrifice Drupad has performed? He has performed sacrifice with this one single motive. I want to destroy Drona, my arch enemy. So Drishtadyumna is born. But the gods take advantage of that. They also give birth to Draupadi. Now, it's not that, you know, there was a fire and Draupadi suddenly came out of the fire. She is described as born into the youth. What does it mean? It's a developed soul which comes with a mission. It's not that physically she is born and she is full-fledged. That's one way to show it. But the real meaning is that she is a conscious being. In fact, it's also described that she was the incarnation, Ansh Avatar of Kali. She came to destroy an empire which had become belligerent, arrogant, the whole Kshatriya Vansh, and therefore her will, single will, which opposes this entire array of people drunken with lust and power. So when we look at the whole battle between the two sides, what else is this but Ahriman, who is preparing the path? So we see in Mahabharata, Ramayana and plenty of Puranic stories, I mean to go into it is endless, and maybe later we can have sessions because there are so many stories. Even now that serial comes on Mahadev, such fascinating stories. Or when we read Vishnu Puran, so many fascinating stories which are the same truth of the Vedas, but is brought in a way that connects to our life force. So we are shown gods who have relationships and, you know, who have children and progeny and who so they show us how we can connect with them. How Shiva connects with his children. What kind of asceticism? For instance, you know, we have this image of ascetic who is wearing a certain dress, whether Giru or white, who lives far away in the jungle, has a long beard. But look at Shiva, the tapaswin. He is married, happily so. He has two children. And who is his companion? On one side, the gods. On the other side, the Vishdhar, Vasuki. Usko bhi gale mein lapeta hua hai. What consciousness is this in which a tapasvi dwells? The whole world as if is his own. Nobody is his enemy. Nobody is his, you know, everybody is dear to him. So it gave to the life force in man a way to live, which was in the light of the Vedas. We too can, like Shiva and Parvati, lead our life. That's why many of the traditions that we have today in India have come from the tantric tradition. They are not from the Vedas. For instance, temples. This came later on. They are derived from the Vedas, but temples are post-tantra. When you have the murti and then you have the pran pratishtha, you invoke the goddess, and then you have to, you know, all these deities. They were not just inner invocation, but also they could be invoked outside. So tantra spoke of the process and the form of things. Vedas were happy with the essential knowledge of things. They didn't care after that. But in life, we need form and processes. We are not happy just with inner knowledge. I mean, this too vast and liberating a knowledge, isa vashyam idam sarvam, it can be disorienting. So what do I do with my everyday life? What do I do with my wife, my children, my... Though Yajnaval gives a very beautiful way to understand it. In the Upanishads, it is there. So Yajnaval is married to Katyayani and Maitreyi. So look at what, I mean, the Ish Upanishad is attributed to him. And he gets married twice and at the end he abandons and walks away. He says, no, I want to now live my life all by myself. So he splits his wealth equally to the two ladies and says, both of you have your equal share and I'm going. So Maitreyi says, well, tell me, I have observed you for long. I don't want this wealth, but I know you have an inner wealth. I want that. So he says, Maitreyi, everybody cannot be an adhikari for that. So, you know, he tries to tell her that be happy. Just don't ask many questions now. But then she asks, no, you give me that wealth. So he agrees. So he says, why does one after all love the wife and child and country and everything else? Now look the beauty of what Yajnaval says. With what far-reaching consequences. He says, Maitreyi, one does not love the wife for the sake of the wife, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the child for the sake of the child, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the country for the sake of the country, but for the sake of the self. Now, this can be understood at two levels. As is the self, so is the nature of our love. When we live in the ego self, our love is small, bound by fears and expectations, and therefore it leads to disappointment, failures, frustrations. But there is another way of loving, and it is everything belongs to the one self, and we are only its trustees. So the love that flows to children, to wife, to husband, to everybody is basically that love. We are simply reflections. We should be ideally reflections of that love reaching out to everybody. That is the deeper sense behind Acharya Devo Bhava, Pitra Devo Bhava, Matra Devo Bhava. The superficial sense is treat the Acharya as God. Modern generation won't accept it, isn't it? What do you mean? You are a God? Show me your powers. Or four hands at least. Pitra Devo Bhava. Father is God. No way. Matri Devo Bhava. Mother is God. Maybe a little bit. Not, you know, when she at least cooks nice things, she is God. But when she says, don't do this, she is definitely not a God. But there is another way to look at it. Acharya Devo Bhava. O teacher, be as the divine teaches us. Be some reflection of that divinity. How does the divine teach? With infinite patience and love. His teaching is very experiential, not a bookish teaching. So all great teachers, know this. Pitra Devo Bhava. Father, be as the divine expresses his fatherhood towards creation. Matra Devo Bhava. Mothers, be as the divine mother deals with the creation. So, in the later tradition, we see there is a connection with the life force. And this connection with the life force has sustained Indian culture. Look at the beauty of Indian culture. It didn't stop with simply... So, at one level, we see Vedas are the root and seed of things. But yet, we see that they also remain, they have their limitations. So, in India, every time a fresh impulse of spirituality comes, because it's the land where spirituality must blossom. And it takes up those truths of the Vedas and gives it a fresh impetus at another level of human being. Vedas are very beautiful for those who are open in their psychic and spiritual life. But otherwise, it's a jumble of words. But Upanishads comes to rescue. Then comes the Tantras and Puranas, connecting with the very life force in man. And of course, the Gita, where it connects with everyday life, human action, takes up the problem of action in grim earnest. Again, it derives from the Vedas, but it gives to it a turn of expression which the human mind can connect with. It speaks of the same Chaturvarnya, which is described in the Purushukta, that Brahmins emerge from his head and Kshatriyas from his arms and Bhuja and Vaishya from the udar and the thighs and Shudra from the feet. So Gita speaks about it, about that I have established the Chaturvarnya. But it gives it a meaning which is more clearer and nearer. And then still something is remaining. This is not over. And what is that regaining? The most remaining, the most material existence. The Veda of the body. Because all these have dealt with first the spiritual existence of man, the Vedas, the mental existence of man, the Upanishads, the vital existence of man, the Puranas and the Tantras. What about the human body? Does it have a destiny? Is there a goal of it? Is it created just only as a pot for the soul to evolve through transmigration, through 84 lakh yonis? Or does it have also a divine truth inbuilt within it? And it must recover in its own terms the truths that the Vedic rishis discovered in their soul, the Upanishadic seers in their mind, and the sages and saints and yogis of Tantra and the Puranas. Is there a way the body can also discover this divine truth? Is there a way that the body can become vast in its consciousness, shedding its physical ego? Like Varuna of old. Is there a way that all the body functions can be brought to harmony with each other according to the cosmic law? The rith of the body. Is there a way that within the body there is a mechanism we can discover that Ariman can fight and battle against all that creates obscurities through movements in our consciousness, movements of desire, lust, greed, anger, etc., fear? Is there a way that the body can discover its own enjoyment, the divine rasa of things? That was the sense of Shubhindu's, that you know, about taste. Is there a way that our very eyes and ears and taste buds, touch can be transmuted so that they can become pure and perfect channels and vehicles of the consciousness of truth, which is also a consciousness of delight? So there we have entry into the age of Sri Aurobindo. He recovers the Vedas and their deep truth. He recovers the Upanishads and its deep truths. He recovers and lays bare for man the deeper respects of Tantra and Purana. But he carries this work to the next logical, inevitable level. And it is the perfection of the very body. But obviously it is incomplete without the others. If somebody believes that one can straight away, the Upanishads base themselves on the Vedas. They drew inspiration from the Vedas and give it at the level of mind. They didn't disconnect themselves from the Vedas. Similarly, the Puranic and Tantric traditions drew from the Vedas and the Upanishads and then gave it a form of expression and processes, Kundalini and all that. So also Sri Aurobindo draws from the Veda, Upanishads, Puranas, Tantras. For instance, there are so many tantric processes in this yoga. The opening of the centers. But it's not that traditional way of Kundalini. The centers open up themselves by the mother's touch. From above downwards. So many things. The Vedic light. Sri Aurobindo, in fact, in one of his famous letters to Nishtha, Woodrow Wilson's daughter, he writes that. That Sri Aurobindo's teaching starts from the ancient Vedic truth. That there is one reality without a second behind this universe. It starts from there. So again, we cannot see that, oh, his teaching is different and totally, you know, disconnected from everything else and start working at the physical transformation. That will be like Virochana, who confused the body for the physical self. It's a paradox that to be a claimant for immortality, we have to be free from the fear of death. I mean, it's a paradox. So Sri Aurobindo comes as a logical culmination and fulfillment of what is glimpsed in the Vedas by the seers in their soul. What is expressed forcefully and beautifully and powerfully and aesthetically by the mind of the Rishi is a mind which had grown illumined by the touch of that light which comes from above. We're living in the rays of the sun, not the sun itself. What is expressed in manifold ways in the Puranic and Tantric tradition, and what is yet to be done with the body. So Sri Aurobindo comes to reveal the hidden Veda of the body, but basing upon all these realizations, these truths have to be recovered, and then they have to be applied at the level of our physical outer existence. And that is the age of Sri Aurobindo. It has just begun, or perhaps not even begun, it's just born. As the mother said, a new world is born, and she reminded us, it's not a new conception of life. A new conception of life is there in the Upanishads. It's not just a new conception, it's not just coming out of ignorance towards knowledge. It is there in the Vedas. It's not just a transformation of our mentality, a reorientation of life, not around the ego, but around the divine. It's there in the Puranas and the Tantras. It's not even certain capacities and powers which we find very powerfully in certain tantric traditions. But it's the very transformation of life, where matter itself, which is the vehicle. And there we come to this story with which we had started. That the first, we spoke about the first fire out of the three. Who is the first deity? The fire. So he is asked, Usasti Chakrayan, who is the second deity? See, we had stopped there. So he says, the second deity is Surya Savitri. The second deity is that, because after that individual realization, we must go to the cosmic and the transcendent. The sun is described as once cosmic as well as transcendent. And then who is the third deity? The last invocation, Ushasti Chakrayan says, is Annam, paradoxically. Matter, food. Because all existence are based upon matter upon earth. So if we don't fulfill that, that's the last step of the sacrifice. And till that is done, life cannot be really fulfilled in the true Vedic way. So this is just a brief overview. It's a very detailed subject which we can explore if there are questions. Yes.
This last part which you mentioned, this knowledge must have been available to Sri Shankaracharya at the time about matter. Why was that overlooked, or how was that so easily overlooked?
Again, what happened post-Vedantic, there was an age of ritualism. It was inevitable because the Vedic symbols. So similarly, Upanishadic writings, the problem is because they illumine the mind. Some people took it that they were basically intellectual formulas of truths. They knew there is truth in it, but they applied the mind to it and not the real heart of the seeker. And they approached it with the mind. Now, just as the Vedic truths vanish when we approach with the scholarly mind. In fact, any spiritual writing, That's one of my big problems with people who scholarly write on even Sri Aurobindo's writings. Because they're not meant for that. They cannot be revealed. You will lose the meaning. And that's what happens to even Sri Aurobindo's writings. So when Shankara applied mind, and he was a brilliant mind, one of the most brilliant mind after Buddha. Of course, I am not talking of Sri Aurobindo and Krishna. Different categories were really distinct. But otherwise, if there are two powerful minds which India has ever seen, is the Buddha and Shankara. And both of them, we see, are coming toward the end of the Upanishadic age. The illumination has come into the mind. Now what will happen? The mind will absorb it and try to figure out. Both Shankara and Buddha did that. So Buddha bases a lot on rationality, and that's why people, especially in the West, Buddha could never take roots in India, paradoxically. But he is very much, people in the West can connect with him. Basically, what he gave the same Vedic lore. He never said that I have broken away from the Vedas. But later interpretation was that he was revolted against the Vedic tradition. No, he revolted against the ritualistic interpretation of the Vedas, which was very correct. Because the Vedas had lost their meaning in mass of rituals. So Buddha said, no, none of this is required. There is an eightfold path of Dharma. And he says that, the path of the Aryan, he uses that word, which was based on that culture. So same thing with Shankara. Shankara used, with his brilliant, powerful intellect, he tried to decipher the meaning of the Vedas. But the thing is, Shankaracharya was also a yogi in the making. He had his own experiences. And to those experiences he could connect, because the Vedic Upanishadic experience speak about a reality which is beyond. Ken Upanishad speaks about it. Yan mansa na manute yena hurmano matan tadeva brahmantam vidhi nedam yadidam upasate. Now those experiences you could connect, but those experiences which are beyond, where the Vedic Rishis and the Upanishadic Rishis say that tasya bhanti, tasya vigyati sarvam, you know all by knowing that, those experiences you couldn't connect. Now this was the deficiency of Shankaracharya's interpretation, that in fact all interpretations, that they are based on half experiences. That's why when Sri Aurobindo was asked this question about, Shankara's Mayavad, he says, well, my objection to Mayavad is very simple. I have experience of Maya. But what do I do when I went beyond it and discovered beyond the personal and the impersonal, the Purushottama? He says, I have to be true to that experience. So eventually the final verdict had to come by experience. That experience can be either through identification or by intuitive mentality or by faith. These are the three doors through which experience can pour in. Sri Aurobindo identified, so he could speak of that. But Shankaracharya remained. He could not really, just don't worry about her. Just, she is with mother's lap. Just don't worry. So, that is the problem with Shankaracharya's interpretation. And same thing happened with the Vedic. See, when they spoke about using the gods as a stairway to reach eventually the transcendent. So human mind tends to think, okay, transcendent is most important. So it discards all this. So that also came up. So by the very nature, mind's approach has this limitation. And though if we see the mass of Shankaracharya's writings toward the end, when he speaks about Saundarya Lehri, the ocean of delight, the wave of delight, he definitely gatistvam, gatistvam, gatistva bhavani. He definitely saw the mother aspect which Vedanta has hinted. It speaks about the white mother filling the dark mother. Veda speaks about it. But it is missed out in traditional Vedanta. Upanishads are called as Vedanta, the essence of Vedic lore. So Shankaracharya came from that tradition. Yet something of that truth about the divine mother, about the Shakti aspect, that Shankaracharya did glimpse later, but probably he could never reconcile, because it's only when you get that you get the rahasya of Prakriti. That's why in Shiv Puran there is a very interesting whole section on Sati Rahasya. One of the devotees of Shiva is who has meditated for thousands of years, and when he comes out, he had a glimpse of Shiva. He was living with him in Kailash, and then he goes into realizing the inner Shiva, when he comes out, he is completely disoriented to see Shiva as a married person. And when he comes to know, he is not married once but twice. He is shocked. He says, you can't be Shiva. How can Shiva be like this? It's a very beautiful story. And then just for one bhakta, Shiva turns the cycle of creation back by thousands of years, as the story goes, and reveals to him the Sati Rahasya, which is about the union of Purusha and Prakriti. Now, these were truths which Shankaracharya could never get. And Prakriti was only for him, you know, ended up being a chalana. And Shubhinda says so powerfully, he says, you cannot slay Maya. Because Maya is what? It is a power of the Lord. That's why Sri Krishna himself says, what is Maya? Maya Duratya. It is my own Maya. How can you slay something which is power of the Lord himself? He can say, he says, but you can slay Moha. Moha you can slay. You cannot slay Maya. But Shankaracharya at that tradition tried to do something which its nature is not possible. So this was the limitations of Shankaracharya. I mean, a great intellect, and he had his own contributions in his own age. But to regard him as the ultimate truth, it would be incorrect. And we see that happening. Now you see what's happening in India, this fight over, how far it is going away from the real Sanatana Dharma, that suddenly there is a debate raging over whether Sai Baba was a Hindu or not a Hindu or Muslim and should be worshipped, not worshipped, Ganges, God knows, everything under creation has come. But it's a good debate because, you know, everything that belongs to the religious interpretation, ritualistic interpretation, will always have a fixed life and vanish after that. Its only task is to preserve the truth in a mold of temporal mentality. When the mentality advances, that interpretation has to be broken. So, whatever his truths have been, they are now not relevant because we cannot connect with that.
You kind of picked my curiosity. You did say that the essence is revealed through the physical, according to
Ananda. Yeah.
Could you tell me how that is done?
Yeah. This actually, in great detail, Mother has described it in the Yoga of the Body, in great detail. How all the experiences that she had in the beginning of the centuries, the experiences of the great Vedic truths she had, of the Upanishadic truths, and she speaks about them in her earlier conversations. She said, I had to lock all of them up, send my mind and vital away, so that the body can now have the same experiences. It's very amazing. How does the body experience dissolution of the ego? Because it'll vanish. And it's a necessity if one has to live the supramental life. Mother says it's one of the important elements. There is a very interesting story which connects directly to the Vedic and the Puranic traditions, that when all these gods used to come to her during meditation, and at one point she asked them that, are you willing to participate in this new creation? So they hemmed and hawed, and of course Sri Krishna says, I'll incarnate. And he alone of all the gods accepted to incarnate in the physical body. And that was, we know, 1926 in Shubhinda's body. But Shiva said, I'll take a body only when the transformation is complete. But tell me, what can I do for this? I can help. So Mother said, dissolve the physical ego. So Shiva, because that's why he's the Lord of Transformation, because he destroys. He's the great destroyer, Mahakal. What did he destroy? Everything that is an obstacle to the spiritual path. That is why also he is the Mokshdayi. That's why he's the holder of the Ganges. That's why his home is Samshan. You know, all this symbolic. So Shiva began to destroy the physical ego. And the mother goes and tells Shubhinda, I have a funny feeling. All my cells are dilating and expanding, and as if they are going far away. Shubhinda heard and looked at her and said, not yet, the time has not yet come. And Mother says, one word of him and everything came back again. Shubhinda talks about this dissolution of the physical ego in his records of yoga. Even experiencing ananda at the most physical level, kaman ananda and maithun ananda, is actually that. The ananda of the highest in the very matter, union of spirit and matter. It is hinted in the Puranas. You know, in the tapasya of Parvati, it is hinted that it's an ascent of consciousness. But here, all the experiences of bliss, of wisdom, of love, of truth, all this must be experience now in the very body, in the body cells, which would mean they would be in time to come when this, you know, this age has just started, when the yoga of the body is perfected, there would be no more error and therefore no more disease, because there would be the true rit. Right now we have to connect with this world through matter, through mind. I must eat this, I shouldn't eat that. It is very, you know, but when we turn to the Veda, what is that reality? It says it is this and that. It is at once this and that. So when this body has finally discovered its own Veda, not just in Mother and Shobindu's body, but that truth is replicated in many bodies, then spontaneously it will be automatically immune from diseases, because Ariman within us will automatically cut away all that is dark, obscure, ignorant. Mitra will automatically harmonize all the various functioning, from the cerebral function to the feet to all the organs. Varuna will reveal the law of truth, will free the body from all that is small and narrow. See, lot of, for instance, medically we say diseases are either because of congestion of organs or because of depletion. Now, again, this is because the life force is moving along very cramped paths. Why? Because our motives are small, or, you know, everything is small. But when Varuna comes and clears all these obstacles, then the human body will itself recover immortality and recover the truth of its being. It's described in great detail in the mother's later conversations, particularly in the agenda. But as I said, it has to be read with a lot of inner maturity. In fact, all spiritual teachings. For instance, in one place she says, you know, going beyond good and evil into a consciousness where both are united, but both lose their character as they are experienced in human life and become something else. Now, obviously, for a human consciousness, it can be very disorienting, but that is the truth. So,
is that therefore experiential rather than anything else?
It's both. First, everything has to be grasped by the mind, then the will must accept it as a possibility, then the experience. Ultimate truth is always experiential. Even the Vedic truths are experiential. But obviously, since we are mental beings, the mind must grasp that it's possible. The second step is the will must accept it. Okay, it's possible, but maybe I would aspire for it. And then the third is the experience. But yes, the experience is the last thing.
Therefore, it defies any logic or analysis.
It should rather be said it has its own logic, but a divine logic. Because logic basically, if we look at logic, logic picks up data from the surface. And according to that, we determine the relation of things. Logic is about that, about relation of things, and based on that, we speak of cause and effect. But as that data changes, we have fresh logic. You know, as they say, the new evidence comes in. So it has its own logic, because the difference between human logic and the divine logic is that human logic is only having a little data. Say, for instance, if I take food, and if I fall ill, so what do people normally say? Oh, khana khaliya tha, bimar ho gaya. Very logical. But many times we take the same food and don't fall ill. So, you know, we have no logic for it. Now, that's because it's not only the food, but also other things. I may be tired that day. My immune system may be at a low ebb. I may be depressed going through. I may not have a will to live. So many now, you see, now as the data multiplies, the logic begins to change. Now to that, a further logic, what the soul wants to experience, how it wants to take a leap. So when mother was asked about certain people, like for instance some deaths in the, you know, people who died, and she says that how the soul chose to go. And that choice has to be respected. I mean, it's amazing. Now that data is obviously not with us. So we may say it is illogical. But to a divine vision, it is perfectly logical. So there is a logic, no doubt. Because human logic is a... All human faculties are, because we are built at one level as a shadow image of the divine, are representative or reflective of a divine functioning. For instance, imagination is a formative power. What is it representative of? Of Maya. Now, imagination defies logic, and yet by imagination we create realities. So if we imagine a ghost, our body doesn't say, oh, it's an imagination. We are afraid. So that's why, you know, when children watch Twilight and all these serials, they have the same disastrous effects as actually encountering a ghost, because eventually your body doesn't register that, oh, it's not a ghost, real ghost. That's why, you know, when people watch, you know, pornographic films and all this, it's the same harmful effect. It saps away the power of love and, you know, only reduces it to lust. It doesn't matter whether actually one, you know, does these things or not. By the mere fact of the mind indulging in imagination, we create our reality. Now, this is a fact. So, the same way, there is something corresponding to human logic, and that is a divine logic. But that is a much wider scope and, you know, ambit of data available to it. It's Trikal Darshi. Again, that we find in many of these stories, that, you know, why things happen, and in stories of Krishna and Rama, as the folklore goes, we see that logic which goes even beyond one life. Logic that extends through many lives. I mean, somebody who came to Sri Aurobindo, I think Srinivas Iyer's brother, and Sri Aurobindo just told him, so you were the great general in Shivaji's time. So he goes back and tells his brother, what is this talking about past life and all? I don't believe in all this stuff. So he asks Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo says, oh, is it? Tell him after 20 years, he will leave his body at the same place where the general had died. How did he leave? Actually, that general died in a prison. And that prison was in Delhi. This man had a heart attack. Now a hospital is there with the same name. And he goes there and he is reminded. Sri Aurobindo spoke about it. Now you see, there is a different logic which operates. Now the divine has all these threads, and that's what Sri Aurobindo describes beautifully in Savitri, the fire inside that knows the secret of all our births, past and future. So therefore it sees the logic behind every event. Why I am going through pain, why I am going through apparent suffering. Otherwise to a human logic, the divine's action appeared totally capricious and illogical. Why, you know, divine's favorite Draupadi, whom Shri Krishna addresses as Sakhi, must undergo such abject humiliation. Why should Abhimanyu die in the prime of his youth? Such a valiant warrior, such a illustrious child, nephew of Krishna and son of Arjuna, and yet his seed will become the future of Aryavarta. I mean, it defies human understanding. What is Abhimanyu's sacrifice? But to a divine vision, they are logical, because it's another kind of logic which operates, which is not just the logic of the form, but the logic of the consciousness. This is beautifully another of the question that Gargi asks Yajnaval. Tell me what is that which is beyond the sky and below the earth and between the sky and the earth. So then of course Yajnaval says it is Sutra Atma, the subtle self which ties all things. Yeah, that's it. Sutra Atma. So it's this which ties all these things in a single thread. So it is the one which... So that is a different logic. So it is logical, but of a different order. It defies human logic, definitely.
Yeah, it kind of looks like, you know, the Maya of Shankara, about which you talked about.
Yeah, except that Maya not with a negative connotation. In the sense that Maya is a fashioner of forms. And it fashions forms for play with a certain purpose. And that's why this Maya itself has two ways of expressing itself. One is the Avidyami Maya, where it completely identifies with the ignorant nature and appears ignorant. Feigns ignorance, as Sri Aurobindo would put it. But behind this Avidyami is the Vidyami Maya. So in nature, everywhere we will see with forms, play of differentiation on the surface and unity consciousness behind. And that's why the Ishupanishad declares, Vidyan cha vidyan cha yast dvedo bhyamsa. He who holds Vidya and Avidya together, who has the consciousness of Vidya and yet deals with Avidya, that means the world of multiplicity. So, of course, the truth of the Maya, as you rightly say. Except that Maya in later years, post Shankara, began to, you know, have a very negative connotation. And that was unfair. It was unfair for creation, unfair for the divine, unfair for manifestation, unfair for the human soul struggling upon, you know, earth. And the greatest paradox was all the great Mayavadins going all over the world to say that life is Maya. Well, if it is Maya, then who is going where and to awaken whom? Then one should actually just really give up life. I mean, one should rather follow the path of the great Tirthankar Mahavira, at least he was true to whatever he believed in, that yes, it is an illusion. So he said, well, then shed food, everything, and eventually he shed the very body. Now there is a greatness in that. That's why he is Mahavir. You know, he is the man who, Vardhaman, who becomes vast by truly following a heroic path. So if we really believe Maya, then that is the path. But if we take it that it is the Maya of the Lord with a purpose in creation, because that path leaves a big question mark on how this came into existence. Why creation at all? Why after at the end of suffering we talk about merger back into that state? It leaves that big question mark. Who created this illusion and what for? If divine created it, then he must be really a cruel person to create an illusion and then at the end of it say, okay, the show is over. It was a nightmare. Get back. I mean, who would subject us to nightmare? So, Shobindu reveals the deeper meaning. Even the Gita reveals. That's why I said the Gita speaks about his own Maya. It is his Maya. So, Maya is something not negative. But Maya reveals a process of the divine in dealing with this manifest creation, where it creates the illusion of multiplicity for a certain purpose. Yeah.
This God is everywhere, you say. Logically, it can be easily proved. Where contains H-E-R-E here? Even there also contains H-E-R-E. So, he is everywhere.
And it also contains H-E-R-Her. So, he is present everywhere as the Divine Mother, as the power of creatrix in creation. Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, there are so many beautiful ways of expressing it. Yeah.
Second thing you said about Vedas, Vedas is knowledge. So, can it be that knowledge is nothing but a truth?
Well, in its original sense, but unfortunately, like the word Maya, knowledge has now come to mean scholastic knowledge, informational knowledge, all kinds of knowledge, which in the original sense is not knowledge but agyan. That's why when they speak about jnana, they speak about vigyan, they speak about sangyan, and they speak about agyan. So from the original sense, Sanskrit, you can apply these terms. So according to Gita, for instance, and even according to one of the Upanishads, all the knowledge about the worldly things alone is agyan. Now, you know, it's something which people would fight tooth and nail. What do you mean? It has such a power. I switch on and the plane fight. So, you know, agyan is a process of knowledge, but a limited knowledge. So agyan is not absence of knowledge. It is in limited knowledge. So, you know, from agyan one goes to the essential knowledge, the jnana. And then from jnana one, like the Gita says, jnana vijnana, how that one knowledge, truth rather, has manifested and expressed itself in millions of forms, that becomes vijnana in the original sense. So that's how the whole search for knowledge proceeds. So it is truth, but only thing is a truth which is at once one and multiple. A truth which is not just a harsh, bare, cut-off, transcendent reality, but a truth which at once is in harmony with the cosmos it has created, and which also dwells in the individual. So we'll need to define that truth. Otherwise it leaves a big gap in understanding, purely from a metaphysical point of view.
So the truth itself, it is true up to nth degree. TH is nth degree.
Yeah, we can say it is infinite.
That is from zero to infinity.
That's why the word used is infinite, which incidentally is one of those things which defies logic. Infinity itself is something that defies logic. I mean, nobody has really experienced infinity.
In Dvaitaranyaka Upanishad, there was one question was asked that, what is that holds the body? And Yajnavalkya said it's a vayu. So which vayu is he talking about?
Speaking about the force of life, which in human being or in material world is manifested by breath. In human beings, it is the swasa. So there is an interconnectedness. For instance, heart in human beings is the center of this pulsation of life. And that's why one of the secrets of longevity is to simply control the heartbeats. It is so interesting. And the breath. Because, you know, it all derives from that. So it is the power. But life, force of life is not just the breath. There is life in the stars. There is life of galaxies. There is life of the cosmos. Scientists talk about it. The universe breathes, it's still breathing, expanding, and it'll contract, which will be like an expiration. So there's life even in matter. But then in human beings, this life expresses itself through certain material processes. So life, but not the life as we understand. Similarly, these five principles which are there in the Vedas, they correspond to the five levels of being. So earth, the principle of matter. Next comes jalam, the immediate vital layer which makes matter flow, makes it grow, pass. Then fire, which is the central moving principle which binds the skies and the earth together. And then you have the vayu, the manifoldedness, expression of thought as it expands. And then you have the space, which is the spiritual element. So all these things come together and weave creation. So again, these are subtle elements, but they also express itself in physical level. So in everything, in matter there is a fire, Jad Agni. In matter there is space, 99.9% is space, empty space. In matter there is also the principle of matter. In earth element is obviously there. In matter there is the power of attraction and repulsion, which is the Jala element, which makes the electrons move around. So in matter also everything is there. In matter there is this constant, that's why this morning we were talking about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is because of the element of Vayu. There is a thought in matter. That's why there are different forms of the periodic table. There are different elements created by the same electron or by basically the essential units are the same. But in manifold ways it expresses itself in different idea forms, like the same genes, DNA, expresses itself in the quality of a tiger, or in the swiftness of a deer, in the strength of a lion. It also expresses in the thoughtful man. So what is this but the quality of Vayu, which manifests itself in many ways. So all these elements are present in every aspect of creation.
So it's a creation, and what causes matter?
It is the condensation of the spirit. It becomes, because originally there is nothing else but spirit. So for its own manifestation, because it has no other substance but out of itself, like in one of the Puranic story, Ganesha is created out of Parvati's washings. So matter by its own self-condensation, self-concealment, becomes a spirit by its own self-concealment, condensation or concentration, becomes matter. And that is why matter can change into spirit. That's why there is a possibility of divine life in matter. Otherwise, if they are forever dual realities disconnected from each other, there would be no way to connect them. There is one reality, and that reality becomes matter, that reality becomes the ethereal world, that reality becomes the many gods. That's why when Yajnavalkya is asked this another question, how many gods are there? So he says, well, 33 crores, or if you may say 3000, or maybe 300, or perhaps 3, or 1.5, or 1. That's how Yajnavalkya answers. So you see the threefold creation, that at each level this one expresses himself in many ways, and mainly at the level of mind, life and matter. So these are threefold creation above, Sat, Chit, Ananda, threefold creation below. And each of these gods further ramifies, becomes, till you can eventually take it to the pyramid where 1.5. 1.5 is the divine and is Shakti. Shakti has come out of himself, is always united with him. She is always rooted in him, and she has gone into the creation simultaneously. So it is half. Look at the beauty of the language. Divine mathematics. She is 1.5. It doesn't say 2, because 2 means they are 2 distinct. 1 foot of the Shakti in the Rig Veda is described as a swan, which has 1 foot on the ground, earth, and the other foot in the sky. So Shakti is always rooted in the divine, in so-called what we call as him, in that being. But something of her has gone into creation. So therefore 1.5. And then beyond 1.5, 1. But eventually you can resolve it to 1, from which everything has come out. So in fact, this has a great relevance even to a revolutionary advance, because all of us advance along one of the lines of the three trinities, which are the original three powers in creation. In Puranas, they were known as the Shiva, Brahma and Vishnu. So this is how the Vedic wisdom, Vedic cosmogony works.
Harapna, you mentioned the word rith many times today. Yeah. I don't think I totally understand what it means.
So, you know, when we use the word vastness, Varuna and Mitra, they are together. So Varuna is vastness. Now the problem is vastness is, you know, Mother describes it beautifully, let's say perfection. Now if you have two elements, you can arrange them on a table. Now if you have three elements, now there is a little bit problem, but you can arrange them. Now imagine that your table is filled with papers. Now it becomes a clutter, but yet you have to arrange it. Now what is the way to arrange it? Take for instance a small hut where there is a vessel and a cot and maybe a chula. So you have a place for everything. Imagine a place where there are many, many things. How do you arrange it? And there are two ways of arranging. One where everything will be discordant. You know, that happens. But another way is where everything will give a sense of harmony. Now, this sense of harmony is something innate. We can intellectualize it. But you know, like when you arrange a room, when you say, well, this is looking nice here, use the word, it's looking nice. If you logically analyze, somebody will say, no, you should keep it here. There were so many ways of arranging. And different human beings will come up with their own logic. But rith is that original divine arrangement or ordainment of things. That's why the word is also, it's the law of truth. How does the truth arrange things in time and space? And if we live according to that, then life is beautiful, harmonious. When we don't live according to that, for instance, as an egoistic person, one may feel life is meant only for my pleasure and enjoyment. Unfortunately, there are also some philosophies which talk about it. So what I do, I deviate from rith. In rith, everything has its place, including what we call today's evil. And you know what is evil according to rith's understanding? That which is not in its place. So we arrange things according to a human logic or a human law. But in rith, there is another way of dealing with things. So today only, you know, we are watching this episode in Mahadev, where this girl who has come out of Mahadev, Mansa, she, you know, out of anger kills with her poison. She belongs to Nagalok. She has come out of that poison which is in Shiva's throat, Vasuki's sister. And very interestingly, what is her real mission? To absorb poison. Just the opposite. But she kills beings with the poison. But when she converts, when she realizes a mistake, then she becomes a goddess who sucks the poison out. Now you see the same person, according to the law of truth, her function was to take away the poison of creation into herself and therefore be like a goddess. But what she does is just the opposite. Because of the egoistic sense, I am powerful, I can kill people. She does just the very opposite, and which is not in accordance with rith. So what is the prashchit that is given by Shiva to her? Normally, you know, if somebody does these acts, tumne ye sab kiya, I'll punish you. Shiva says, no, now I'm giving you the power to absorb back the poison. So she is given the prashchit that because you have killed some, for lives to come, for a great aeon of time, you will absorb everybody's poison and relieve them of their pain and suffering. Now look, this is how rith operates. Because rith is also like law from the divine point of view. That is justice. So you see, divine justice is one with compassion. So rith is essentially the right arrangement of things according to a divine vision and a divine law. And because we don't follow that, our life becomes a very messy thing. And it's very difficult to discover it so long as we live in the sense of the ego and desire. Because it always clouds the true law of things, rith. That's why, because Krishna knows the rith, which is one with dharma and vastness, he asks Arjuna to destroy his own relatives. Now, you know, in the human law you say, oh, this is not done. But Krishna knows that in the law of truth, this has to be. So this is the sense of rith, and Arjuna would do a greater evil by not participating in that massacre than by participating in it. So, you know, that's how rith is the right arrangement of things in time and space according to a divine vision or a divine law of things. Because truth is one and vast, but that leaves us nowhere. There is also multiplicity. So, one can get lost. So, what is my relation with this or that? So, I may say, Shivoham, Shivoham, Sachidanandam. Name Panchvayu, Namira Mata hai, Pita hai. But, what do I do with this world of manifold relation? So, this is a divine arrangement of things. That we have to discover. That is Rith. So, Vedic Rishis wanted to discover it. In Ishupanishad is described very interestingly. Yajnavalk prays to the... And that is the supramental law. So that's why Shubhendu emphasizes on that. Even till lower mind you don't discover Rith. So Yajnavalk prays, Hiranmayena patrena satyasyapihi tammukham tattvam pushanya pavranu satya dharmaye drishtaye. I want to... dharma here means that. What is that law of truth? I want to see that. Satya dharmaye drishtaye. So it is the dharma according to the vision of truth. Not dharma according to our mental conceptions of what is right and wrong. But according to a deeper vision of things. That's why the actions of many of these Vedic rishis is so difficult to understand. Because they lived in a consciousness which was vast and impregnated with the law of truth. And human consciousness gets baffled. When we read these stories, they are fascinating and charming, but also sometimes mind-boggling.
What is the subject matter for tomorrow?
We'll take on from where we are living. The age of Sri Aurobindo, we talk at great length about that. Or we can also have many more questions. We'll see what Rith reveals to us. Yes, please.
You talk about Nan Vidna. But in one of the book of Ramakrishna, I read Nan Vidna and then Vi Vidna.
And?
Vi Vidna. That is Vishishta Vidna. So can you tell something about
this? Well, in what context? Because I have read Sri Ramakrishna, but somehow this has not struck me. I have read his gospel, his works and Swami Vivekananda's works. But if I have to intuitively arrive at, what he would have meant. So, it would mean that there is, normally when we use the word Gyan Vigyan. So, the essential truth as applied to the universal becoming. That's how normally Gyan Vigyan is used. But Vivigyan would means the transcendent self in that sense. So, that truth which upholds the transcendent or the way the transcendent weaves himself into the creation, that's what would mean according to an intuitive sense of things. But if I get the passage, I'll know it, what exactly he would have meant. But I feel that's how he must have meant.
So, can we do one more? Patanjali Yoga Darshan and Aravind philosophy.
Yes, so as we see that, yes, that's very, very valid. So as we see that at the end of every age, I am connecting to the subject, there was a tendency to codify things into, the gods assumed fixed functions, the inner process which was very wide and plastic, assumed very rigid external rituals. So also at the end of the Upanishadic age, in Upanishads the paths are not fixed. The process is not fixed that, you should do this, that. The Rishi will give a very general terms, the path of the truth, the path of the light, Brahmacharya Nitya, follow the law of Brahmacharya, Risho Yaptakama, conquest of desire. They will speak in very general terms. But they will not tell exactly how to do it. Because they allow that freedom to the human consciousness to evolve. Once it has the aspiration for truth, it will find the way. Whereas later on, these paths became very fixed and rigid. Therefore, we started Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga and Raj Yoga. So the paths also became highly specialized. And Sri Aurobindo says at the beginning in the synthesis, it has great disadvantages because it takes away the freedom and flexibility and also the subtlety of the actual yoga. That's why, when people often look for, in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, is there an easy to do three-step spirituality? Well, it's not, and thankfully it is not. Because it, only somebody who has not walked the path will think about it this way. Like, well, Sri Aurobindo says, this is what you must do. Keep your mind quiet, reject the thoughts, and then, you know, invoke the mother. Very fine. Whole lifetime will be spent in doing it. So, you know, knowing the difficulties of the human journey and the many-sidedness and the complexity, these great rishis, of whom Sri Aurobindo, of course, at one level is part of that great inheritance, would not give this. But Patanjali, post-Upanishadic age, wanted to codify things so that human intellect can grasp it. Because as we have seen, Upanishads was about it. So he takes out that, and particularly the system of Raj Yoga. So he started, okay, first practice Yama, Niyamas, and for each one he gave some basic principles, etc., etc. Then he talks about stabilizing the physical matter, then stabilizing the nervous system through asana and pranayama, then stabilizing the mind through dhyana and dharana, and eventually his goal is samadhi, to merge into the absolute. To start with, the very goal in Sri Aurobindo's yoga is different. It's not a merger, it's not a samadhi in the way Patanjali describes it, but samadhi in the way Sri Krishna describes it. Because this question is asked to Sri Krishna. What is samadhi? And Sri Krishna describes in very interesting terms. You could be engaged in battle in a state of samadhi. So it's a state of consciousness. Not a certain intensity in which you are lost in the absolute. Not a state of oblivion. But in Patanjali, it is samadhi is a state of withdrawal from the world, and so he prepares the sadhak step by step. Because that's how Patanjali understood the lore of the Upanishads. Because they point towards an absolute. So there was a tendency in the human mind to create a transcendent distinction between that and this. Whereas when you ask the Upanishadic Rishis, what is that, he'll say, as I said, he will say it is here and there, as you were saying. So, you know, one is confused, how can it be here and there at the same time? Because human mind loves to have contrast and contradictions. So Patanjali's goal is very different. It's for an individual soul's release from the bonds of birth and death. The Upanishads and the Vedas never really kept that as a goal. That was a later interpretation of the... They were in quest of immortality, which is a very different thing. But later on, immortality meant not entering into the human body at all. But immortality is a consciousness. And one can be in a consciousness of immortality, even though the body is mortal. One is in that state where one knows. One is conscious even after death. So this is where Patanjali is a very special and limited application, or not even an application, but a codification of a very vast and complex yoga. So, but it, you know, it has its advantages, because for the human mind it appeals, okay, I have to do these things. But as I said, just practicing one of the yamas or niyamas is not an easy task, because human nature is so complex. Even if one wants to, you know, it's so beautifully shown in the Upanishad, like if one wants to practice truth. So if a terrorist comes looking for a person who has hidden in our house seeking shelter, should I speak truth or should I not speak the truth? Now here my truth is coming at variance with justice and compassion. How do I harmonize all these? So Patanjali doesn't deal with all this complexity, because he's not concerned with the cosmic movement at all. His task is very limited and individual. Whereas Sri Aurobindo's yoga, in the line of the great Vedas, it's not just an application of the great truths discovered by the Veda to an individual, but to the whole of human race and to the earth, to the very matter itself. So the goal is very, very different. So the process is very different. So there are no yama niyama in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, but the emergence of the psyche. Mental rules always create rigidity. Very beautifully, that again, that episode. You know, Bhishma asked this interesting question to Ganges. Maa, tumhara santanu mein, tum to pavitra karti ho sabko. You make everything pure. Why is it that I became an instrument for so much evil in this world? So much adharma, unwittingly. Then she says, you know, because you understood dharma in a very external way and you stuck to it rigidly. So that's what yama and niyama are, pure mental rules. And mental rules create so much rigidity in the consciousness that paradoxically that rigidity prevents us from moving towards the divine. That's why when we read Sri Aurobindo's list of rejections, it speaks even about rejection of minds, ideas, thoughts, insistence, divine should be like this and not like this, and this is divine, that is not divine. She says, a time comes when it's difficult to say what is divine and what is not divine. But you have to yet use that distinction for practical application in real life. But yet, at one level, it is impossible to say, because the mind enters into that state of all is the divine. So, but Patanjali doesn't deal with this issue, because his idea is withdrawal from life. But if we follow really that path, which is a very narrow and rugged path, basically it's a form of Raj Yoga. Some element of bhakti is there when he talks about, you know, surrender to the God, and some aspects of jnana are there. But his main goal is very different. And so the process. In Shubhindo's yoga, there is no yama and niyama, but psychic emergence which should show us. And opening of the higher faculties like Dakshina. She should show us what is to be done and what is not to be done. Not according to mental conceptions of right and wrong, but according to the rith, the higher law of things.
So you just talked about one and half God and one God. Isn't Vedanta about only God or one God?
Isn't?
Only God, there is only God. Then there is only one God.
So yeah.
Everything is nothing but God.
Yes.
But there is one God.
And yes.
The reason why I am asking you this is one of the talks about with mother I was reading, and mother questioned, somebody was talking about Sampurna Avatara. And she questioned how Sampurna Avatara is possible. So is that in that regard that the everything cannot become condensed into one being? Pervading through all.
But the other side, complementary side, is that the one is also multiple at the same time. So that's where these 33 crore devatas come in. But it's true that one need not go through that process. So mother's talks are in that context, that, you know, the path of the Vedas goes through all the various gods. But it's not necessary, because we contain the one, the supreme, within ourselves. And we can take a direct route. This is one of the differences between the Vedic yogas and the yoga of the Mother and Shubhindu. In fact, I was thinking of highlighting this tomorrow, certain other aspects which have revolutionized the very way of yoga. But restricted to the question, basically this one only is also infinite. So by its very nature, it expresses itself in infinite ways. So how does he express? That's where he brings out of himself the power and the knowledge, and that is the half part. And it's not half in a lesser sense. It's half in the sense that it's rooted in the one, but moves towards infinity. Ekam satyam vipra bahuda vadanti, or, you know, that ekam eko vashi sar bhutantaratma, yet it goes into different worlds. In that sense, it is one and one and a half. And that half part is the one which goes into this creation, and yet one leg remains rooted firmly in the foundation of the one. In Ivish Upanishad, it is described as Matrishvan. In that, the waters of the being are held together. And why this is important? This is practical implication. The practical implication is because one part of creation is always rooted through its power into the consciousness of the one. Therefore, creation can climb back to the one. If it was two, then it won't be. So it is one only. And if we have nothing to do with creation, we can only use the word one. But if you give me the exact sentence of, you know, what mother has said, then I'll immediately see in what context she has said. Because many things she has said in a certain context. As I said, she says, you need not go through these gods. There is a certain context to that. Okay, so we'll close here.
Yeah.